This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls 2 by Elena Favilli and Francesca Cavallo.
Read by Alicia Keys.
Ashley Judd.
Danai Gurira.
Esperanza Spalding.
Janine Garofalo.
Mojan Marnow.
Philippa Sue.
Samira Wiley.
And Rowan Blanchard.
With an introduction read by the authors. Publisher's note. This audiobook includes a bonus PDF of 2 written exercises, which can be viewed on any smartphone, tablet, Mac, or PC computer.
To the rebel girls of the world, you are the promise. You are the force. Don't step back, and everyone will move forward.
Preface, read for you by Elena Favilli
and Francesca Cavallo.
Dearest Rebels, as you listen to this, the first volume of Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls is on the nightstands of about 1 million people. All over the world, children and grown-ups are talking about their favorite rebel girl. Teachers are designing lessons around these pioneers. Politicians are reading these stories at political conventions. Young women are opening the book to cheer up after a bad day. And soon-to-be dads are buying it to welcome their daughters into this world.
Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls has been translated into more than 30 languages. And every day we have the feeling that we hear all of your accents when we receive the messages you send us via email, Facebook, and Twitter. When we see the Instagram pictures of this book in your homes, it's a lot like looking at a family album. A family made up of people of every religion, every nationality, every color, every age, every kind. A global family whose members come from small villages like the ones we grew up in and from big cities.
1 year ago, in our small Los Angeles apartment, we started a little fire. A fire we could gather around to tell each other new kinds of stories.
You joined us. You invited your friends and brought more firewood. You came bringing your hopes, your frustrations, your courage, and your fear, your weakness, and your strength. You came to listen, but you also came to speak. The fire got bigger. The family grew.
And this is what Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls 2 is about. It's about the stories you told us by that fire. It's about the Asian American female firefighter whom Christine told us about in New York City. It's about the first all-female anti-poaching unit in South Africa, which Rita told us about on Snapchat. It's about the Irish pilot who built herself a plane. Aidan told us about her at a signing event.
Some say that stories can't change the world, but we disagree.
Time and again, you messaged us to say you had discovered a story in our book, and sometimes the story you mentioned wasn't there. The fact is that Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls is training hundreds of thousands of people to see stories they couldn't see before. It's inspiring them to look for talent where they thought there was none. It's making it easier to find potential in unpredictable places.
When we tap into the talent of an entire population, instead of just half of it, endless possibilities open up.
When we see each other for what we are, free of harmful stereotypes, we create real progress.
When we recognize oppression and take action to end it, we all become stronger.
As you rest your head on your pillow after reading one or three of these stories, whether it's after an exhausting day of play or a long day at work, whether you're in Cape Town or Eroréa, whether someone read you the story or you read it by yourself, know that you've just sat by a fire with hundreds of thousands of fellow rebels who, just like you, are on a journey.
The Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls series is a small part of a conversation that is bigger than each of us, bigger than our individual hopes, certainly bigger than our fears.
Thank you for sitting with us by this fire.
Now, let's get started.
Agatha Christie, writer. The best time to plan a book is while you're doing the dishes. Born September 15th, 1890. Died January 12th, 1976, United Kingdom. Once upon a time, there was a girl who loved to write. Poems, love stories, mysteries, letters. She tried them all. Agatha wanted to be a professional writer more than anything. She talked about her dream with her dog, George Washington, during their daily walks. Each new place she and George visited, Agatha looked at as a setting for a story. And every time she met someone, she wondered if that person could be one of her characters. Agatha sent her stories to magazines but got turned down. The rejection letters kept piling up, but Agatha didn't let that stop her. She was an avid reader and especially loved murder mysteries. So she wrote her own detective novel. The Mysterious Affair at Stiles featured Hercule Poirot, a Belgian detective with a glorious mustache. Many publishers turned down Agatha's manuscript, but finally, one said yes. When the novel was published, it was a huge success and marked the beginning of an unbelievable career. Agatha Christie's books have sold more than 2 billion copies and have been translated into over 100 different languages, making her the best-selling novelist of all time. Hercule Poirot, with his pointy mustache, and Miss Marple, with her cute hats, became two of the most popular literary detectives ever. They appeared in TV shows and movies and kept millions of people guessing as they figured out whodunit. Through her remarkable career, Agatha wrote 66 detective novels, 14 short story collections, and the world's longest-running play, The Mousetrap.
Ashulpan Nurgayev, Eagle Huntress. I plan to teach my younger sister eagle hunting. Born 2003, Mongolia. Once there was a 13-year-old girl named Ashulpan who lived in the icy cold Altai Mountains. For 7 generations, the men in her tribe had hunted with golden eagles to provide their families with food and fur. Golden eagles are big, fierce creatures with sharp claws and curved beaks that can be extremely dangerous. But to Ashulpan, they were simply beautiful. She longed to train an eagle of her own, so one day she said to her father, "Dad, I know that no girls have ever done this, but if you teach me, I'll be good." Her father, who was a great eagle hunter, paused to think. Then he said, "You are strong. You are not afraid. You can do it." Her heart sang with joy. Ashulpan and her dad rode their horses high into the snowy mountains. Finding an eaglet to train wasn't easy. Ashulpan reached a nest with a rope tied around her waist, trying not to slip on the sharp rocks. In the nest, she found a tiny golden eagle, all alone. She covered the bird's head with a blanket to calm her down, then brought her home. Ashulpan sang and told stories so that the eaglet would recognize her voice. She fed her small chunks of meat and taught her how to land on her glove. "I treat her with respect, because if she trusts me, she won't fly away. We will be a team for a few years. Then I'll return her to the wild. The circle of life must continue." Ashulpan became the first woman to enter the Golden Eagle competition in Olgi, Mongolia. After her, 3 more girls started training to become eagle hunters.
Alice Ball, chemist, born July 24th, 1892,
died December 31st, 1916, United States of America. Once upon a time, there was no cure for leprosy, a disease that attacks the body and can leave victims terribly disfigured. Because there was no treatment and people believed leprosy was very contagious, sufferers used to be isolated in leper colonies with nothing to do but wait for death, or for a cure to be found. In search of that cure, an incredibly talented young Hawaiian chemist called Alice Ball was studying the properties of an oil extracted from the Chalmugra tree. This oil was used in traditional Chinese and Indian medicine to treat skin diseases, and it also had been used for leprosy, with mixed results. Sometimes it worked, and sometimes it didn't. Why? Was Alice's burning question. Why doesn't it work every time? She teamed up with an assistant surgeon at a Honolulu hospital to try to find the answer to that question. She developed a way to separate out the active elements of Chalmugra oil and created a new extract that could be injected directly into a patient's bloodstream, with amazing results. Unfortunately, Alice died before she was able to publish her findings. So, the University of Hawaii did it for her, without giving her credit. The president of the university even called the extraction technique the Dean Method, as if he had invented it himself. Many years later, Alice Ball's amazing contribution was finally recognized. Now, every 4 years on February 29th, Hawaii celebrates Alice Ball Day. Alice was the first African American and the first woman to graduate from the University of Hawaii.
André Pio, French resistance fighter. I was destined always to be a fighter. Born February 3, 1905, died March 5, 2010, France. Once upon a time, there was a young woman who ran a beauty parlor. André was smart and stylish, and she always had a bright smile for her customers. Bonjour, madame, she would call out. How would you like your hair cut today? Then, the Second World War broke out, and everything changed. When Hitler invaded her country, André joined the French Resistance, a network of ordinary people who worked in secret against the Nazis. She helped distribute underground newspapers to other members of the resistance. It was risky and dangerous work. André was soon promoted to sergeant and given the code name Agent Rose. Many times, she risked her life. She would steal out at night and line up a row of flaming torches to signal to Allied planes as they crossed enemy lines. The pilots looked for these bright spots and knew that they could land safely there thanks to Agent Rose. She helped save over 100 British pilots from being captured by the Nazis before she herself was captured and sent to a concentration camp. Sick, starving, and dressed in blue and white striped pajamas, André was lined up with other prisoners in front of a firing squad, about to be shot when Allied troops arrived and saved them. André was hailed as a hero. The President of the United States and the British Prime Minister both sent her letters to thank her for everything she had done. She went on to live a long life, but she always kept a scrap of that blue and white material to remind her of those terrible days and to confirm that, as she said, miracles do exist.
Angela Merkel, Chancellor. What we seek is harmony among nations. That was and remains the greatest goal of European unity. Born July 17th, 1954, Germany. Once upon a time in Templin, Germany, there lived a 7-year-old girl called Angela. One Sunday, she was listening to her father's sermon in church when her mother started to cry. "What's the matter?" Angela asked. "They are going to build a wall," her mother said. They want to seal off the border between East Germany and West Germany. Angela was stunned. Why would they build a wall? She thought. People should be free to go wherever they like. Not only would East Germans be stopped from going to the West, but they would be barred from listening to the news coming from the other side. Every day, Angela would hide in the school washroom with a little radio and try to catch a station from the West. It was illegal to do this, but she didn't care. She wanted to know what was happening to her country. When Angela grew up, she studied quantum chemistry and wanted to become a university professor. The secret police told her that she would be promoted only if she spied for them. Angela refused, and she never became a professor. She was working as a researcher in a lab when the Berlin Wall was demolished. She called her mom and said, "I think we're free to go to the West." Indeed, they were. Angela eventually became Chancellor of Germany, a determined leader who knew the pain walls could cause and never wanted her people to be divided again.
Anita Garibaldi, revolutionary. Do not be afraid to live, to run after dreams. Be afraid to stand still. Born August 30th, 1821, died August 4th, 1849, Brazil. Once upon a time, there was a skilled horsewoman who loved freedom. Her name was Anita. Her country, Brazil, was going through a difficult time. An emperor ruled the country, and a group of rebels, called ragamuffins, had started an uprising to replace him with politicians who would be voted in by ordinary Brazilians. Anita believed in democracy. So even though she knew that the ragamuffins had little chance of beating the mighty imperial army, she joined their fight. One day, a bearded Italian man called Giuseppe Garibaldi walked into a cafe. Anita and Giuseppe looked at each other, fell instantly in love, and decided to travel together to wherever the battle was bloodiest. Anita was 7 months pregnant when things got ugly for the rebels. Giuseppe ordered a retreat, but Anita kept fighting, even after her horse was killed. Total chaos broke out, and the two lost sight of each other. Anita was captured and told by imperial troops that Giuseppe was dead. Heartbroken, she asked permission to cross back into enemy territory on foot to look for his body. When she couldn't find him, she stole a horse and escaped, crossing a raging river by hanging onto the horse's tail so she wouldn't be swept away. She traveled for days until, exhausted, she reached a farm. And there, she found Giuseppe. The two hugged and kissed, ecstatic to be together for the birth of their first son, Menotti. The Ragamuffin War was just the first in a series of battles Anita and Giuseppe fought together. Eventually, her name came to symbolize freedom and courage all over the world.
Anne Bonny, Pirate. Follow me at your own peril. Born March 8, 1702, died April 22nd. 1782, Ireland. Anne was a girl with wild red hair. She was scruffy and tough, and she used to hang out with pirates at the port taverns. When she grew up, she even married one called John Bonny. Together they sailed to the Bahamas, but when John started spying on his fellow pirates for the British government, Anne left him and ran away with a pirate captain named John Rackham. Calico Jack, as he was known, was famous for wearing flamboyant trousers made from striped calico cloth. Anne's best friend was a dressmaker called Pierre. One day, they decided to rob a French merchant vessel that was passing by. They splashed blood on their sails, the ship's deck, and themselves. They put one of Pierre's dresses on a mannequin and splashed that with blood too. By the light of the full moon, they sailed silently toward the French ship. When they were close enough for the other crew to see, Anne appeared next to the mannequin, brandishing an axe. Terrified, the sailors abandoned ship without a fight. Anne also became friends with another woman pirate named Mary Reed. Disguised as a man, Mary was part of the crew on a ship that Anne and Calico Jack had captured. Anne and Mary took charge of the ship, which was called the Revenge. They dressed sometimes as men and sometimes as women and became inseparable. When the British Navy ordered the crew of the Revenge to surrender, Anne and Mary fought back fiercely, but because their fellow sailors were drunk, they were quickly captured.
Audrey Hepburn, actress. As you grow older, you will discover that you have two hands, one for helping yourself, the other for helping others. Born May 4th, 1929, died January 20th, 1993, Belgium. Once upon a time in Holland, there was a little girl named Audrey who ate tulips. It wasn't because she loved flowers, though. It was because she was so hungry. Life in Holland during the Second World War was hard. There was never enough food on the table, and Audrey often felt the pangs of hunger in her empty stomach. Tulip bulbs didn't taste good, but they kept her from starving. When Audrey was older, she moved to England and became a film actress. She was admired the world over for her elegant figure and her luminous beauty. Famous fashion designers flocked to her, and she became a style icon, known for her little black dress, long gloves, and diamond tiara. After her most famous film, Breakfast at Tiffany's, was released, the Hepburn look became so popular that women used to dress just like her. They would even visit the famous jewelry store in New York City to stand on the same spot she did. But Audrey wanted to do more than just star in films and be admired for her clothes. She wanted to help others, especially poor and hungry children. Children who were as hungry as she had once been. She dedicated her life to serving UNICEF, the same charity that had helped her when she was a girl during the war. She believed that no child should ever be so hungry she would have to eat flower bulbs. When Audrey died, a new pure white tulip was named in her honor to celebrate the wonderful work she did for UNICEF.
Beatrice Veal, fencer. I don't take no for an answer. Born March 4th, 1997, Italy. Once upon a time, there was an Italian girl who was a formidable fencer. Her name was Beatrice, but everyone called her Bibi. While she was in middle school, Bibi became very ill. By the time her parents got her to the hospital, she was fighting for her life. She had contracted meningitis, a severe illness that attacks the brain and spinal cord. And to save her, the doctors had to amputate her legs and her forearms. Bibi was in the hospital for more than 100 days. When she recovered from surgery, she had one goal in mind, to go back to fencing. Nearly everyone told her it was impossible, but Bibi had a plan. First, she relearned how to walk, shower, open windows, and brush her teeth. She even taught her classmates how to use her brand new artificial limbs. Then she strapped her foil to her arm and started training again. As the only wheelchair fencer in the world without arms and legs, Bibi had to invent a technique that would work just for her. After a while, she was ready to try competing again. In a few years, and with the help of two of the most famous fencing teachers in Italy, she became a champion. She won the World Cup in Canada, the European Championships in Italy, the World Championship in Hungary, and the gold medal at the Paralympics in Rio de Janeiro. To be special, Bibi says, you need to turn your weakness into the thing you're most proud of.
Beatrix Potter, writer and illustrator. There is something delicious about writing the first words of a story. You never quite know where they'll take you. Born July 28, 1866. Died December 22, 1943. United Kingdom. Once upon a time in London, there lived a girl who loved to paint animals. Beatrix spent all year looking forward to the summer holidays when she and her little brother could escape the drab, gray city streets for the wild highlands of Scotland. As soon as she unpacked her bags, Beatrix would gather up her paints and brushes, pull on her boots, and head outside. She sat so quietly that field mice would scamper past her, and rabbits would hop up and nibble the grass at her feet. The squirrels got quite used to her sitting at the edge of the woods as they chased each other through the branches above her head. When she was old enough, Beatrix left the city and moved to the countryside. One day, she sent a letter to a young friend of hers, a little boy called Noel. In the letter, she made up a story about a naughty rabbit in a smart blue jacket who steals vegetables from the garden next door and is chased by the farmer. Beatrix named him Peter, after her own pet rabbit. Noel loved the story and wanted more, so Beatrix kept writing to him and even included pictures of Peter and his three siblings, Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail. Eventually, she published the story as an illustrated book. Millions of children came to love Beatrix Potter's books and her unforgettable characters, including Mrs. Tiggywinkle, Squirrel Nutkin and the Two Naughty Mice, Tom Thumb, and Hunka Munka. Her very first book, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, became one of the most popular children's stories of all time.
Beyoncé, singer, songwriter, and businesswoman. Okay, ladies, now let's get information. Born September 4th, 1981, United States of America. Beyoncé was 6 years old when her dad started selling people tickets to go to their house and see her sing and dance. When Beyoncé told her mom she wanted to create a band with her friends, her mom said, "Okay, I'll make your costumes." And so Destiny's Child was born. Beyoncé was the queen of the band. She was driven, focused, and interested in learning as much as possible about every aspect of the music business. At first, her dad was her manager. But when she decided she wanted to be in control of her career, Beyoncé asked him to step aside. Madonna, the great singer-songwriter, was her role model. Like Madonna, Beyoncé didn't just want to be a popular singer, she wanted to be a powerhouse. And that's what she became. One song at a time, one album at a time, one concert at a time, Beyoncé forged her own path and became an inspiration to people around the world. She sang about freedom, about love, about independence, and about pain, both personal pain and social injustice. She inspired millions of Black women to be proud of their culture, of their origins, of their own unique style. When Beyoncé was asked to perform during the halftime show of the Super Bowl, the biggest sporting event in the United States, she entered the stadium leading an army of female dancers all dressed in black. With her compelling song, Formation, she dropped a Black Power anthem in front of 100 million viewers. Today, she is the most influential living pop star in the whole world.
Billie Jean King, tennis player. If you're going to make an error, make a doozy and don't be afraid to hit the ball. Born November 22, 1943. United States of America. Once, there was a formidable tennis player called Billie Jean. She was a great champion who won all the most important tennis tournaments of her day. But there was something she found profoundly bothersome. At the time, female players earned only a fraction of the prize money that male players made. Why should women put up with being paid less? Billie Jean protested. We sell the same number of tickets. That's just how it is, the tournament organizers replied. Do something about it, she said, or I will boycott your tournament. The tournament organizers laughed at her, but she wasn't joking. She got together with 9 other female tennis players, and they created their own circuit with 19 tournaments and many big sponsors. The battle for equality in tennis had just begun. A woman's place is in the kitchen, not on the tennis court, proclaimed Bobby Riggs, a male tennis player who strongly believed that women were worth less than men. Oh yeah, said Billie Jean. I'll show you. They played each other in a historic match called the Battle of the Sexes. 30,000 people in the stadium and 50 million television viewers watched Billie Jean beat Riggs in straight sets. Organizers of the U.S. Open finally met her demand, making it the first major tennis tournament to offer equal prize money to men and women. Thanks to Billie Jean, today tennis is one of the few sports where female and male athletes have achieved equal pay in all the biggest tournaments.
The Black Mambas, Rangers. We are fighting for our animals and showing people that women can be beautiful and strong. Started 2007, South Africa. One day, a park warden named Craig put together an all-female team of rangers to stop poachers in the South African savannah. He called them the Black Mambas. He recruited high school graduates from the community surrounding the wildlife park. It's important to protect the rhinos, he explained, so future generations will see them for real and not just on posters. He gave the women uniforms and set up a training program. The Black Mambas learned how to survive in the savannah, how to spot animal traps, and what to do when they encountered lions, elephants, buffaloes, and hyenas. They learned how to track poachers and patrol the park's perimeter fence, armed with only pepper spray and handcuffs. This war on poaching is bigger than guns and bullets, declared Nomutu Magakene, one of the Mambas. We are the eyes and ears of the reserves. We're doing things differently. The Black Mambas took great pride in their work. They talked to people about the importance of rhinos in their communities and about how lucky they were to live in one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. They gave presentations in schools and taught children that it was wrong to cooperate with poachers and lay traps in the park. They became heroes. To be a Black Mamba means to be a tough and strong lady, said Nomutu, one who can work in the bushes without fear. It took only a year of Black Mamba patrols for the snaring to disappear almost completely and the rhino killings to stop entirely.
Boudica, Queen. I am not fighting for my kingdom and wealth now. I am fighting as an ordinary person for my lost freedom, my bruised body, and my outraged daughters. Circa 33 to 61, United Kingdom. Once upon a time, there was a fearless warrior queen who spearheaded a rebellion against the Romans. Boudica was just 28 years old when she led her tribe, the Iceni, into battle. Her husband, the king, had died and left his kingdom to her. But the Roman emperor, Nero, decided that no woman could rule an area under Roman control, and he sent his troops to enslave the Britons. The noble Iceni were killed or imprisoned. Their queen was made to walk naked in the street, and her daughters were whipped. Boudica wanted revenge for this humiliating treatment. She gathered together a tribal army and led an attack against the mighty Roman Empire. With her long red hair flying and her sword held high over her head, she struck fear into the hearts of her enemies. Her army stormed the city of Colchester in southeastern England, destroying the temple of Claudius, the former Roman emperor, and killing thousands of Romans and their supporters. Even more Britons joined Boudicca, and by the time she reached London, her army was 100,000 strong, all of them loyal to the rebel queen. But despite being heavily outnumbered, the Romans, who had better weapons, won, and Boudicca died fighting. Her name comes from the Celtic word Buda, meaning victory. For her bravery and her strength, she came to symbolize the fighting spirit of the British. Today, you can still see a huge bronze statue of Boudicca and her daughters driving a magnificent horse-drawn carriage in London near Westminster Bridge.
Brenda Milner, neuropsychologist. I am incredibly curious about the little things I see around me. Born July 15th, 1918, United Kingdom. Brenda wanted to understand how the brain works, so she studied psychology at Cambridge University. After college, she moved to Canada and pursued her PhD at the Montreal Neurological Institute. She was such a good student that she was offered a position as a professor at McGill University, but much to everyone's astonishment, she turned it down. Her colleagues told her, "You're a psychologist in a neurological institute. This is no place to build your career." And Brenda answered simply, "I like it here." Shortly after, she was asked to work with a special patient who had undergone surgery to remove the temporal lobes on both sides of his brain, making it impossible for him to create new long-term memories. Every day, Brenda would sit with the man, running different tests and taking detailed notes. Eventually, she started to notice something strange. Each morning, her patient showed improvement on all the tests, even though he had no memory of doing them the day before. It was a groundbreaking discovery. Brenda realized that the brain has at least two different memory systems, one that handles names, faces, and experiences, and a second that handles motor skills, such as swimming or playing the piano. "It was the most exciting moment of my life," she recalled. Brenda would sit with patients, talk to them, and write down every tiny detail they told her. In this way, she was able to detect specific brain injuries. Brenda is considered the founder of neuropsychology and one of the world's leading experts on memory.
Buffalo Calf Road Woman. Warrior. Circa 1850s to May 1879. United States of America. Once upon a time, there was a girl who saved her brother during a battle. She was Cheyenne, and her name was Buffalo Calf Road Woman. At the time, settlers and government soldiers were determined to steal the land from the Native Americans who were its original inhabitants. As General George Crook led his troops across the Great Plains toward her village, Buffalo Calf Road Woman took her gun, leapt onto her horse, and joined the Cheyenne men to fight back. Some of them protested that because she was a woman, she couldn't take part in the fight. But she had already pushed her horse into a gallop, a cloud of dust billowing behind her. The battle was raging when she suddenly spotted her brother, comes in sight, trapped in a gully and surrounded by Crook's soldiers. Fearlessly, Buffalo Calf Road Woman sprinted down the ditch with bullets flying all around. She pulled her brother onto her horse, and they galloped off together to safety. It was a breathtaking rescue. The other warriors couldn't believe their eyes. They hadn't been nearly as brave as Buffalo Calf Road Woman. If it hadn't been for her, Comes in Sight would have been killed. They felt diminished by her courage and didn't want anyone to know what had happened, so they agreed never to talk about her feat. But one valiant warrior called Wooden Leg spoke up. It's because of him that today we know the wonderful story of one of the bravest warriors in the West, Buffalo Calf Road Woman.
Madam C.J. Walker, businesswoman. I am not satisfied in making money for myself. I endeavor to provide employment for hundreds of the women of my race. December 23, 1867 to May 25, 1919, United States of America. Once upon a time, on a cotton plantation in Louisiana, a girl named Sarah was born. Sarah's four older siblings had been born into slavery, as had their parents before them. But thanks to an important law called the Emancipation Proclamation, Sarah was the first in her family to be born free. When Sarah was 14, she moved to St. Louis, Missouri. There, she worked as a washerwoman for $1.50 a day. At night, she attended school. During that time, Sarah started losing her hair, so she experimented with various products and treatments to help it grow back again. None of the available products was quite right for her, however. What if I could create a hair treatment specifically for African Americans? She wondered. Her husband, who worked in advertising, loved the idea. He suggested she change her name to Madam C.J. Walker to make her products more appealing. And so she did. Sarah started traveling the country to promote her hair care line and gave demonstrations of the Walker system, a hair care formula that used homemade pomade, a scented oil, heated combs, and a particular style of brushing to stimulate hair growth. Her demonstrations were so popular, she started hiring other women to promote her products, and soon, Walker agents became well known all over the country. Sarah's success encouraged other women to create their own companies, and she supported many charities providing educational opportunities for African Americans. Madam C.J. Walker became the first female self-made millionaire in America.
Carmen Amaya, dancer. Trousers are unforgiving. They show up every mistake and they give you nothing to take hold of. November 2nd, 1918 to November 19th, 1963. Spain. The night Carmen Amaya came into the world, Barcelona was lashed by a terrible storm. Thunder boomed, lightning crashed, and the rain turned the narrow lanes into raging streams of filthy water. Carmen's family were Romani gypsies, and flamenco dancing was in their blood. When Carmen's father first saw her dance, he wondered if something of that storm had entered his daughter's veins when she was born. Carmen learned flamenco steps from her aunt, who was herself a great dancer. But the little girl never played by the rules. She made up her own. To earn money, she danced barefoot in the tavernas down by the waterfront. She gained the respect of even the toughest sailors, who nicknamed her La Capitana, the captain. Soon she began to perform in big theaters. She earned enough money for her family to move out of the shack where she was born and into a decent apartment. They could afford to eat ham sandwiches instead of sardines. On stage, Carmen preferred tight-fitting trousers and a high-cut bolero jacket to the traje de flamenca, the traditional dress worn by female dancers. When she first appeared like that, the audience was in an uproar. How dare this slip of a girl wear men's clothing? But when she began to dance, Carmen silenced them all. Stamping out lightning-fast rhythms on the stage, she sometimes broke the floorboards. Her footwork was so ferocious, said one member of the audience. Her dancing was almost supernatural. Carmen was such an incredible dancer that to this day, she is remembered as the Queen of the Gypsies.
Celia Cruz, singer. Oh, no need to cry. Life is a carnival.
Born October 21st, 1925. Died July 16th, 2003. Cuba. Once, in the poor quarter of Havana, Cuba, a young girl used to sing her brothers and sisters to sleep. What an incredible voice, said the neighbors. She sings like an angel. When Celia was older, her cousin entered her in a singing competition on a local radio station. She came first,
and won a cake as a prize.
Celia loved to sing Santeria songs in the Yoruba language of West Africa. Her father disapproved of her singing and wanted her to become a teacher. But music, and especially the bewitching rhythms of salsa, ran through Celia's veins. She joined the National Conservatory of Music and started to make recordings. One day, a popular salsa band called La Sonora Matancera needed a new singer. This was Celia's big break, and she leapt at the chance. But soon after, a revolution broke out in Cuba, and many musicians fled to the United States. Celia was one of them. Still, she never forgot where she came from. One day, when she was at a cafe in Miami, a waiter asked her if she took her coffee with or without sugar. "Are you crazy?" she laughed. "I'm Cuban. We always have azúcar." From then on, whenever she was on stage, she would cry out, "Azúcar! Sugar!" and the crowd would go wild. With her flamboyant personality, her amazing voice, and her infectious rhythms, Celia helped to make salsa music wildly popular in America. She recorded more than 70 albums, won several Grammy Awards, and was the undisputed queen of salsa for 40 years.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, writer. Racism should never have happened, and so you don't get a cookie for reducing it. Born September 15, 1977, Nigeria. Once upon a time in Nigeria, there was a little girl called Chimamanda who loved books. She read all the books she could find, and when she was 7 years old, she started to write her own stories. Chimamanda had always lived in Nigeria. She snacked on mangoes and played in the sun all year long. Still, all the characters in her stories were white. They had blue eyes, ate apples, and played in the snow. "I didn't think people with chocolate-colored skin could be in books," she said. One day, Chimamanda realized that was a silly thought, and started to look for African books with African people in them. Even though she lived in Africa, these were harder to find than European or American books full of white people. But when she did, she thought it was great to see people who looked like her as characters in books. She wanted to see more of them. Chimamanda became an exceptional writer. She traveled the world and told stories about Nigeria and America, about women and men, about migration and hair salons, about fashion and war. She had a witty sense of humor and an amazing gift for explaining apparently complicated things clearly. People loved her books. They loved her speeches. They shared videos of her lectures with one another to feel inspired and empowered. Chimamanda became a passionate advocate for gender equality. "Some people say women should be subordinate to men because it's our culture," she said. "But culture is constantly changing. Culture does not make people. People make culture."
Christina of Sweden, Queen. It is a far greater happiness to obey no one than to rule the whole world. December 8, 1626 to April 19, 1689. Sweden. Once upon a time, there was a 6-year-old queen. Her name was Christina, and she had succeeded her father on the throne upon his death. Christina was smart and fiercely independent. Because she had a lot of responsibility on her shoulders, she knew she had to grow up fast, so she studied philosophy, art, foreign languages, and even ballet to be able to move as gracefully as a queen. When Christina turned 18, everyone expected her to marry a suitable man from a noble family, someone to increase her power. But she was in love with one of her ladies-in-waiting, a young and beautiful woman called Ebba Sparre, and she had no interest in marriage. After reigning for 10 years, Christina shocked everyone by giving up the throne and moving to Rome. There she had a wonderful time, making friends with artists, writers, scientists, and musicians from all over Europe. She realized that she missed being queen, however, and plotted to seize control of the kingdom of Naples, but her plan quickly fell apart. Pope Alexander II called her a queen without a realm, a Christian without faith, and a woman without shame. And he was right. Christina was never ashamed to show the world who she really was, even in the face of criticism. She was unconventional, and she loved it. Thanks to her free spirit, she became one of the most influential women of her times. In Rome, Christina formed the literary circle that gave rise to the Academy of Arcadia, an institute for literature and philosophy that exists to this day.
Clara Rockmore, musician. I was fascinated by the idea of playing in the air. March 9, 1911 to May 10, 1998, Lithuania. One day in Russia, a 4-year-old girl stood on a table and started playing the violin. Her name was Clara, and she was auditioning for the St. Petersburg Conservatory. Clara was a child prodigy, and she had her heart set on becoming a famous violinist. After the Russian Revolution, though, Clara's parents decided to flee the country. They undertook a difficult and dangerous journey that was partly paid for by concerts given by Clara and her sister along the way. By the time they reached New York City, Clara had developed a weakness in her arm that forced her to abandon the violin. She was heartbroken. Before long, however, Clara saw something miraculous, an instrument that could be played without being touched at all. The performer stood in front of an electronic deck and waved her hands between two antennas. Her movements were picked up by the device and transmitted as music, like a magician weaving a spell. This strange new instrument was called the theremin, for its inventor, Leon Theremin. "I can play in the air," said Clara. "It is so beautiful." The theremin was hard to play, but she was a natural. She became a pioneer of electronic music and the world's most famous theremist. Her hands floated over the theremin, and the sweetest, most enchanting melodies materialized out of thin air. Leon Theremin fell in love with Clara. He made her a birthday cake that spun and lit up as soon as she got close to it. He proposed to her many times, but Clara never married him.
Clara Schumann, pianist and composer. If I have known much trouble in my youth, I have also known much joy. September 13, 1819 to May 20, 1896, Germany. By the time Clara was 8 years old, she was already an extraordinary pianist. After one of her concerts in a private home, she was approached by a 17-year-old boy. His name was Robert Schumann, and he was a pianist, too. He told Clara that she was fantastic, and the two were soon good friends. Clara traveled throughout Europe giving concerts, and she became one of the most famous composers and pianists of her time. Robert was also a great composer, and their shared love of music brought the two closer and closer until they married when Clara was 21. At the time, female musicians were expected to stop working after marriage. Some people believed that composing music would take away the energy needed to deliver and raise children. But for Clara, playing and composing music was not just a job. It was her passion, her skill, her reason for living. She had no intention of giving it up. She and Robert eventually had 7 children, and Clara gave hundreds of concerts, more than any other contemporary pianist. She also composed more than 20 piano works, a concerto, chamber music, and several shorter songs. Clara and Robert loved each other dearly, and when he died, she stopped composing and devoted her life to playing his music to audiences around the world. Years later, as she herself lay dying, she asked her nephew to play the Romance in F-sharp major.